For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So I'll just say a couple things before I introduce Brian, who really needs no introduction. However, I just want to welcome Alex, who's here from somewhere on his way to somewhere. I think from North Carolina on his way to Minnesota. And I believe that I think that Carmen might be in. Corrales, yeah. Do you recognize any other?
Sue and Carmen and Chris Cadman.
Okay, yeah. Great. So everyone else, I think we kind of know each other. So this is our final Monday night practice discussion or talk of our practice period. So we're in week 8 at the end of the road, making our way towards Sesshin. And it's very auspicious that Brian Taylor is here from Corrales, who practiced with us for about a decade, right?
Yep.
In person. And how many lifetimes, we don't know. But we began this kind of delving into the teachings of our great woman ancestor, Joko Beck. And now Brian, who spent about a decade practicing with Joko Beck, auspiciously happened to be in town at this very moment. So we can kind of, isn't that wild? We didn't plan it. You know, it just happened. So it's really wonderful that he can come here. I just want to remind everyone before we get going that Sesshin begins on Friday, Saturday, and it concludes on Sunday. Everyone in the Sangha is invited to the reception for our Shuso Pala, which will be about 4:30 or so in our backyard after Sesshin. And then those of you in the practice period, of course, are welcome to, of course, offer a question to Paula if you're here in person. And if not, you can always email me one. And we'll have a Dharma Inquiry Ceremony, Hosen Shiki, for Shuso Pala on Sunday afternoon around 2. And people can also online can tune into that. So I'm thinking, is there anything else I want to say? I just want to appreciate everyone's great effort during these 8 weeks. And we still have a little ways to go. But I could even feel like we're serving tea in the Zendo, kind of like we do during Sesshin, kind of coming together and collecting our hearts and minds together. So I think I've probably said enough about Brian. You can say anything you'd like to about yourself as introduction, but he has been with us for a long time and continues in spirit, even though he moved back to his beloved Albuquerque and Corrales is adjacent to that with his wife, and actually even has a new sitting group that he started called Corrales Zen. So it's really a delight to have you with us, Brian, and
thank
please
you.
Take
thank
it
you.
Away.
Thank you.
Tell us your...
Yeah, and some of the folks for that sitting group are online right now, so hello, everybody. I wanted to say also that with the years of practice that I had with many of you, probably about half of you and all of you online, I think, that was really a transformative time for me. And... where do I do this? Put it here?
Put on your
lapel.
Oh, okay.
Not only transformative, but kind of life-saving in some ways. And I will always be grateful for this community and for many of you. It continues. I mean, I still consider this a home sangha for me, and Hogetsu is my teacher, and she continues to offer me guidance in practice and study, and also occasional conversations about the group in Corrales that has just started up, which is a Zazen group, informal, and but it's off to a really great start. So I thank you for your support all these years and continuing. Joko Beck was one of the early women teachers in Western Zen. And she was of a generation of women who had, and women who followed them, continue to have a profound effect on Zen in the West, including Hogetsu. There is, I don't want to get into it because that's a whole other talk about what that effect has looked like as I've seen it over the last 30 years. But the women teachers who followed the first generation of male teachers in this country had a way of opening up Zen and Zazen in a very humane way. That continues, and we wouldn't have the character of Zen that we have in the West were it not for these women. And now it's probably, what, 50-50 something, male and female teachers, something like that. Joko was one of the teachers that was featured in a wonderful book I'm rereading right now called Meetings with Remarkable Women. Have any of you seen that? Raise your hand online, or... It's a great book if you want to learn about the first generation of women teachers in the West, and she was one of them who's featured in there. And they did it was done in the late 80s, and they did an a newly edited version in 2000. So there's some updates. It's really good, and it really gets into more depth of what I'm just beginning with here, as far as the effect of women teachers. The way I began studying with Joko in the very early 90s was I was going through a time of difficulty in my life, and was in a bookstore in Denver, Colorado, and saw a book called Everyday Zen, and I picked it out and started looking at it. And it was one of those things, I'm sure you've had this kind of experience, where it just the words are like, oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And I need this book, and I need to really spend time with it. And I read it, and I really reflected on its approach, and I took the liberty of calling up Joko and saying, I'd like to meet you. And I was going out to San Diego. I lived in Albuquerque at the time. And so on a trip to San Diego, she met with me, we talked, and she said, well, why don't you come to a session? And I began going about twice a year to sessions at the San Diego Zen Center, which is in a residential building like this, except it's one story, like a lot of houses in California, and continued. And my wife went, and I ended up starting a... I was working as a parish priest, an Episcopal priest at the time, and started a contemplative prayer slash Zen group. And then it became eventually a center where we had workshops and retreats and things. And two of Joko's Dharma heirs came out for weekends and led retreats with our people. One of them was Elizabeth Hamilton, whose husband Ezra Beda you may have heard of because he's published some books, and also Diane Rosetto in Oakland. And I also studied with them out west, and then they came, as I said, to California, Albuquerque, and we worked together. So that was kind of the content of our time together. And in between sessions during that decade, I was doing occasional phone conversations with Joko, who started doing that before there was such a thing as Zoom or Skype. And that was very, very helpful during that time. She was very instrumental in helping me find a way at the time of bringing together contemplative prayer and Zazen and the teachings also. Since that time, since the time I retired about 12, 13 years ago, I really have left that part of it behind and have focused entirely on Zen practice and Zen teachings on its own terms. But during that time, it was very, very helpful. I want to talk tonight about one thing that the main thing that Joko did, or let me put it this way, the main thing that I got from Joko, and how I worked with that over a period of many years. This is not just a quick thing. And she always made it clear that this is years and years we're talking about. And what she emphasized was unique in the Zen world at the time. And, you know, we talk in Zen practice with Zazen that it is, I would call it kind of a process of subtraction, that if awakening is unfolding over time, it does so in part because we are coming to awareness of our particular ways of obscuring awakening. We're coming to awareness about our attachments and aversions, our delusions, our ways of thinking and behaving and framing reality in a way that block awakening from unfolding in our lives. And we, of course, we can go on a whole life blocking that. But practice is really learning to, in a way, subtract it. So it's not a process of addition. We're not building a kind of inner awakening, building enlightenment. We're allowing something to unfold that's already naturally there, that we have managed to obscure, and taking away the obfuscation. Is that the right word? Mm-hmm. And so when we sit in Zazen, those ways of obscuring what Shunryu Suzuki called big mind become apparent. And Joko's uniqueness was that where many Zen teachers advise one to notice thinking and just simply label it thinking and be done with it, and call it monkey mind. And people who talk about their experience with sitting in meditation will often say, oh, my mind is so active, it's just busy mind, it's crazy, I just, you know, throw it out and, you know, try to be present in the moment without the thinking mind. What was unique about Joko is that she brought a curiosity and a kind of precision to the question, what is it you particularly are doing? What is it that your mind of delusion and aversion and attachment, your mind, your conditioned mind, what is it actually doing? And pay attention. Some people thought that was sort of a psychological approach, as if you were analyzing yourself and coming up with some sort of a big theory about who you are and what you did. That's not it at all. What Joko started with always, and finished with it too, was label your thoughts. It was a practice of not just thinking, stop thinking, but thinking angry, planning, or whatever it was, worrying about my mother, or scaring myself, or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. And the remarkable thing about it that she talked about a lot and I discovered is that when you start doing that and you keep doing it, it's the same stuff over and over and over and over again. And it's different from you than it is for me because of your conditioning, the way you grew up, the kind of survival techniques you adopted before you even knew you adopted them. So for one person, it may be viewing so-called random thoughts that are actually thoughts that are always about anger, or that are angry, I should say. And for another person, it may always be fear, or another person, it might always be trying to figure everything out. And it can be a thought about going to the grocery store, or about something you're working on at work, or it could be something about politics, or it could be something about a relationship you're in. It doesn't, the setting of it doesn't matter. It's what you're doing with that thought internally and what it is that generates a kind of spinning process where you keep rehashing something in the same way over and over and over again. And so she would say, label your thoughts precisely and then feel it in your body. Don't think about it. Don't try to analyze what you're doing. It's like, let's, for instance, angry thought, because you noticed you were remembering something that happened, or you were imagining somebody at the grocery store getting the can of beans you wanted before you did, or you were driving in the car. It doesn't matter. The angry thought is what keeps being brought up in different ways, and labeling it angry, and then pretty much immediately dropping into the body below the thought, and noticing exactly what is it like in your body when that's happening. What is it like right then? And to feel it fully. And what Joko taught, and I think this is a pretty unusual approach to Zazen at the time it was, is getting to know yourself, getting to know what stands in the way of awakening in an intimate way and a repetitive way over a period of years, thousands of times. Then she would teach about learning to take that off the cushion into daily life. So that she used to talk about reactivity being whatever form of reactivity your mind tends to take, being like the idiot lights on a dashboard of a car. It's, you know, like you're low on oil. It's like angry, tensing up, afraid, whatever it is that you're doing, if you've begun to notice this is what my brain does repetitively, it's a dharma gate. It's a alarm bell. And at that point, you stop, you notice it, you feel it, and you do it in daily life. And you discover where in daily life you tend to get your buttons pushed. For me at the time, and she loved the things in life that we don't like. I mean, it was like, when that stuff happens, it's golden. And when you notice it, it's diamond. I mean, you that's where you really want to be, is noticing those things in daily life. And for me at the time, I was going through a very, very painful public relationship with a bishop who hated what I was doing with welcoming gay and lesbian people in my church, and publicly would say terrible things that weren't true about me. And it was an awful situation. And boy, did that trigger me. I mean, it was just like, my blood pressure would just go way up as soon as I read something or he said something or whatever. And I would talk to Joko about this, and she would say to me, "Brian, the bishop is your teacher. Be grateful that you have this in your life. It's a wonderful opportunity." You're getting right to the core there, you know, if you use it as practice. And so she was really into practicing with the difficulties of life and the things that we don't like, uncomfortable experiences. And she would include that, the core of that for Sesshin was always difficulty in sitting. Now, she wasn't going so far as to, you know, sit through anything and be really macho and just, you know, make yourself die there on the cushion. But she was very clear that, you know, sit through discomfort. If you've got an itch, don't itch it. Just feel what that itch is like. If your leg goes to sleep, let it go to sleep. Get up carefully when you stand. You know, if you try to find a comfortable position that you can sustain, but you're going to have difficulty in sitting, especially on Sesshin, and that's part of it. And that's a gateway for you. And to see what your mind does when that's happening. It's like, why should I have to do this? I've been doing this 10 years. Why is it still hurting? And what's wrong with me? How come I can't do this better? Or whatever your mind tends to do, that's where it comes up, is in difficulty. And that's a great place to realize what it is you do. And so we get to know the conditioned mind specifically, completely, experientially, not analytically. And then it tends to open up. It tends to... those things tend to lose their power. And we tend to see them more quickly as they arise, and see what we're doing and feel it and let go of it, so that what's left is this kind of empty, open awareness that is natural and is not obscured by our delusions and our attachments and aversions that we're constantly doing. Now, I want to give you a specific example of how I have done that and how it has evolved for me past what Joko initially, what I initially learned from Joko, let me put it that way. And that is that I discovered during that kind of sitting over those years and following that I would be thinking, and I still do it, it's hardwired in my brain, I would be thinking, imagining situations that might be real, real possibilities or just imaginary that would need sorting out, and I would need to address and maybe fix, and it might be conflict or it might be something not quite going the way I want it to, and it can be small or large, and then ruminating about how I would make it go the way I wanted it to so that I would get what I need in life. It might be a pretend conversation with somebody. It might be a conflict that I had. It might be being late for an airplane. It might be something, whatever. And I got to know that pretty well, and the physical experience of it and dropping below the thought into the body. And what was very helpful for me as an extension of what Joko was teaching and what I was practicing was learning in therapy that this is something that started sometime in my first 5 years of life. My father was a very serious alcoholic and behaved in some outrageous, dangerous ways that created a chaotic environment in my home. My mother, on the other hand, either couldn't because I was only 3 years old or wouldn't, I'm not sure which, or a combination, speak about it. So there was this silence, but there was this feeling, something's terribly wrong. Something is terribly wrong, and I don't know what it is, you know, as a little three-year-old. And so, and I can't really talk to my mother about it, obviously, so what I'm going to do, and this was my survival technique, is I am going to anticipate things and think about things ahead of time before they happen so that I'll survive it, and I will know how to get what I need in life. I learned that in therapy. Well, that made the practice itself much more profound, because when I had a little thought about something that I might be worried about and trying to figure it out, I knew at that point it was not just a mental pattern. It was a survival. It was life or death for this little three-year-old. And I was able to feel it more fully and recognize where it came from, not intellectually, but in the body, remembered. And after some years of doing that, I found that not only would I be able to recognize it really quickly and take it seriously and pay attention to it right then, but whether it was on the pillow, the Zazen cushion, or in daily life, but I discovered that in a way it had become a self-perpetuating pattern to recognize it and feel it and let go of it. It was in a way, it was coddling my delusion, my patterns, so that it's as if this little three-year-old knew that he would get comforted by the adult me by tensing up and having this thought thing going on and then being recognized and felt and then let go of. And I realized that at that point, it was no longer useful for me to keep practicing that way with so-called random thoughts, but rather to say to them, as if I'm speaking to a little child, enough of that now. Grow up. Go away. I'm not going to engage with you. I know what this is about. I'm not going to keep doing it. And that's where I've been the last few years with it, and it's been extremely helpful. However, for Joko, this process of labeling thoughts and feeling them in the body was not, even though she emphasized it a lot, it was only a technique. It was not like the main thing. because she really taught over and over again something that she, that I wrote down a quote from her book, Everyday Zen. So the crux of Zazen is this. All we must do is constantly to create a little shift from the spinning world we've got in our heads to right here and now. That was a technique to make that little shift and to get to the point where we could say, oh, I see what I'm doing here. Okay, boom. I want to say something that actually was articulated extremely well by one of her early Dharma heirs, Barry Majid. Is that how you say his name? Majid, psychotherapist in New York City, who went on to have his own center there. And he was at the beginning of your practice commitment period when Hogetsu shared with you some readings and videos and things at the very beginning for you to look at to orient you to some of these teachers, and with Joko in this case. A short article by Barry Majid was featured in what was given to you, which you might want to go look at again, in which he said something very profound about Joko that I'd always felt but couldn't quite put into words, and that is, I think the downside of Joko's way of talking about practice was that it could turn into a kind of endless project in which you're always monitoring yourself, always fixing yourself, always trying to wear out expectation and preference so that practice was vigilant and lifelong, and you're never there yet. And if you read, I hadn't read Everyday Zen in years, and I went back to it and read it while you were reading it during this spring. And I sure picked that up. I was seeing it with fresh eyes after years of practice, and I was saying, you know, Joko's always saying, well, you haven't quite got it. You know, you're there, you're close, but you're really miles apart. And it was kind of always like that. And that's, I think, part of the downside of that. Nevertheless, the important message from Joko for me, I think, and for the Zen world all over was and is, we can't leapfrog over our conditioned way of thinking and simply dismiss it as thinking. We can't leapfrog over it to big mind. We have to study the self before we can forget the self and be actualized. And that's part of Dogen's Genjo Koan, which she used to refer to all the time. And that's the saying that you've heard many times here. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. This was Joko's way of doing that. To study the self is to forget the self, because it's only a technique. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things, which is to be awakened and be oriented towards what's happening rather than what we're creating in our heads. So that's a little bit about Joko and a little bit of about what I learned from her and how I continue to work with her even in the years after I was with her, and I'm always grateful to her for what I was able to learn from her, what I continue to learn from her teachings.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions
Heavens are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.